psalm is kind of interesting, and we're this isn't going to be an incredibly deep dive into the psalm, but it's kind of an interesting psalm because there's two pieces of it, and the second half is actually Psalm 70 also. So Psalm 70 is verses 13 down through the end, kind of this prayer for help. This lament portion of the psalm is also Psalm 70. So there's some questions about maybe which one came first, sort of like our 2 Peter 2 and Jude questions. But these are both from David. So likely seems like Psalm 70 was just a psalm as a piece of this one that they sang separately or on its own. But there are kind of different moods to this song. It's difficult to have one theme to identify it. But we're going to go ahead and just read through this and then break it into its component pieces and go from there. So Psalm 40, this is to the chief musician, a psalm of David. I forgot to turn that on. One second. Okay, to the chief musician, a psalm of David. I waited patiently for the Lord, and he inclined to me, and he heard my cry. He also brought me up out of a horrible pit, out of the miry clay, and set my feet upon a rock, and established my steps. He has put a new song in my mouth, praise to our God. Many will see it and fear and will trust in the Lord. Blessed is that man who makes the Lord his trust and does not respect the proud, nor such as turn aside to lies. Many, O Lord my God, are your wonderful works which you have done, and your thoughts toward us cannot be recounted to you in order. If I would declare and speak of them, they are more than can be numbered. Sacrifice and offering you did not desire. My ears you have opened. Burnt offering and sin offering you did not require. Then I said, behold, I come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me, I delight to do your will, O my God, and your law is written within my heart. I have proclaimed the good news of righteousness in the assembly. Indeed, I do not restrain my lips. O Lord, you yourself know. I have not hidden your righteousness within my heart. I have declared your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your loving kindness and your truth from the great assembly. Do not withhold your tender mercies from me, O Lord. Let your loving kindness and your truth continually preserve me. For innumerable evils have surrounded me. My iniquities have overtaken me so that I am not able to look up. They are more than the hairs of my head, therefore my heart fails me. Be pleased, O Lord, to deliver me. O Lord, make haste to help me. Let them be ashamed and brought to mutual confusion who seek to destroy my life. Let them be driven backward and brought to dishonor who wish me evil. Let them be confounded because of their shame who say to me, aha, aha. Let all those who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. Let such as love your salvation say continually, the Lord be magnified. But I am poor and needy. Yet the Lord thinks upon me. You are my help and my deliverer. Do not delay, O my God. Okay, Psalm 40. What we're going to do first is, as we've did back when we were studying the Psalms, I want to give you guys a moment to just sort of look through this psalm. To some of you, it may be maybe an old friend, and some of you, it might be the first time you've read it in a while and relatively unfamiliar. So as you read through that, as we did just now, and as you look through it now, what are the chief components or the section breaks, perhaps, that you see some different themes as we go throughout? Okay, a break between 3 and 4. And what are you seeing there, Don? Okay. Not recently, not in the Psalm class we just did, but I'm sure we have probably passed when we did Psalms on Wednesday nights years ago. So, okay, so you have the psalmist's experience of what happened to him in 1-3. And this is part of what makes the psalm unique in that he starts with, it seems as though it's been resolved, it's over. When a psalm of lament normally starts with the trial or the difficulty, and then he turns to trust, but it's not always resolved in the psalm. So that's one thing that's unique about this one, is that it's also a psalm of praise, sort of a post-trauma, like post-situation rejoicing. So he's saying, God heard me, and he drew me out of the horrible pit. So there's that experience in 1-3. You could perhaps include 4 and maybe even 5 in that section, but yes. In 1-3 anyways is the experience. What else do you see? Okay, so you have 4 and 5, and then 6-10. Probably.
Yeah, 4 and 5.
Okay, so 4 and 5, he's making observations.
I'm sorry, 6-11.
And then 6-11.
Through 10.
Okay, so between 10 and 11. Okay, so you do start with the experience. And then you do move to, yes, some observations could be a good word to describe that. He's talking in verse 5 about the many wonderful works of God. And then there is a definite break between 5 and 6 because he moves to talking about sacrifice and offering. These two things, sacrifice and offering, or burnt offering and sin offering. He's saying God, for some reason in the psalm, it looks like he doesn't desire that. That's not what he wants. He doesn't want sacrifice. He wants something different. And that section goes 6-through, he says, instead, I'm going to delight to do your will in verse 8, and your law is written within my heart. And there is a break after 8. Because starting in verse 9, he describes what he's done as a result of deliverance. After deliverance, as often happens in the psalm, the proper response to that is what? Once you're delivered, what ought you to do? Praise. You move to praise. And not just, again, as the psalmists often call us, not just personal praise, internal praise, but being willing to say, even here in the great assembly, you know, like, this is what God has done. This is who he is. This is his character that was displayed to me. And I'm not going to hide that. I'm going to reveal that. And that goes through verse 10. So 9 and 10 is a description of the psalmist not concealing the work of God in the great assembly. Then you have 11, which really is, I think, the heartbeat of the psalm. Do not withhold your tender mercies from me, O Lord. Let your loving kindness and your truth continually preserve me. Then he moves to, actually, in verse 12, just considering the scenario that was happening. Perhaps the scenario from which he was drawn out of and placed upon the rock. Innumerable evils have surrounded me. My iniquities have overtaken me. I can't even look up or I can't see more than the hairs of my head. Therefore, my heart fails me. And that's sort of a description of the scenario. Then following that, 13 through 16, we have his prayer. Mostly against the wicked, 13, 14, 15. Well, I suppose 14, 15. So 14 and 15, we'll look at those closer in a little bit. There's three parallel lines. And then 16 is concerning the righteous. And he ends on this note in verse 17 in his prayer, but it seems to be this contrast, like the in-between, like the in-between of when innumerable evils were surrounding him before he was lifted up onto the rock. This is how he felt. I am poor and needy. He's still in the situation here. He's still in the middle of the trial. Yet he's trusting that the Lord thinks upon him. You are my help and my deliverer. Do not delay, right? Come quickly, which was the same thing that he prays here in verse 13. Make haste to help me. So that's kind of the flow of the song. It is, again, just a bit interesting because it's hard to categorize. It looks like a couple different ones, and it's hard to tell at what point in the situation he is sometimes at different points in the song. But let's just walk through this a little bit more closely. In the experience that he talks about, he describes it like a horrible pit with miry clay in the bottom of it. So the image is probably that of an unused or out of, not out of date, but out of commission cistern, perhaps like the one that Joseph was thrown into, like this pit that they throw Joseph into. And at the bottom of it, there's still some water or there's still some mud. And so it's just this dark, lonely, muddy, gross, dirty, no one's there, no one to hear you. Maybe even going back to the illustration of like, I can't even see what's going on. He's in this sort of oppressive situation. Maybe he ties it later to the fruit of some of his sin. He also ties it seemingly to evil people that have come against him. So whatever the scenario may be, he describes it as a horrible pit, miry clay. And the contrast being when the Lord delivered him, it was like, you know, you can just almost hear his feet just being like sucked out of the mud. Someone there to help him, reaching an arm down, delivering him, and then setting his feet on something secure. No longer sinking in the mud, no longer dirty, no longer unstable, no longer my shoes, my sandals are coming off. None of that. It's like steady, secure, stable, delivered. It's over. My steps are established. It's not moving anymore. And what accompanied that deliverance was the praise, was this song put into the psalmist's mouth. The song of deliverance, the song of rejoicing. And so it is important as we walk away. I walked to this psalm this week partially because just the weight of so many things going on in each of our church family's lives. Just so many weighty situations. A lot of physical things that have been happening to many people. And it's just heavy, heavy. There's other circumstances too, even unrelated to one person, but simply unsafe family or things like that. But there have been, you know, we've been praying for Rosenkip. We've been praying for Ed and Ellen. We've been, you know, praying for Nancy, praying for so many different people. I was just thinking about this, that as we wait for deliverance, that when deliverance comes, the proper response for us is to rejoice. It's to sing a song of praise. If doxology isn't the end of your trial, then the purpose wasn't accomplished. Because the reason God delivers is to bring himself praise. And so that's what we ought to do. He's put a new song in my mouth, praise to our God. So not only does the psalmist himself experience it, But then the praise expounds beyond the psalmist into the assembly, perhaps even beyond the assembly into the nations. And many people get to observe, or you could say, hear the song of deliverance, hear the psalmist write down, I was in the miry pit and God pulled me out and he put me onto a rock. And they listen to that song and it promotes the fear and trust in the Lord. And so he brings it back then full circle, because if you would be the one in the miry pit, if God has chosen to place you there, and in his sovereignty he chooses to draw you out, and you sing a song, and people hear it, and they fear, and they trust in the Lord, then I would say, like David, blessed is that man who makes the Lord his trust. He can rest assured in deliverance, and he has the opportunity to have the praises of God resound from his mouth, and to watch and observe as many other people are impacted by what God has done through his life. That's a pretty unique privilege. It's a painful privilege, but a privilege nonetheless, that we would be the mouthpiece of the praise of God. The only one that, I mean, this man who makes the Lord his trust, we have the parallel line. What does it look like to make the Lord your trust? Well, to not respect the proud, nor turn aside to lies. And I think this does draw us back just to remember, at the very least, that in the middle of the miry pit, it would be easy to believe deceptions. It would be easy to be drawn away. If there ever is a circumstance that would cause a faithful man to turn from his faith, it would be the miry pit. And so we need to remember in those moments, you know, don't listen to these false teachers of Jude. Don't listen to the false teachers of 2 Peter. Don't listen to the deceptions of your heart. It is deceitful. It does lead us away. Don't listen to those desires for peace and for quiet and for no pain above your desire to praise and glorify God. Don't make that exchange, because blessed is the man who makes the Lord his trust. So that's kind of this introduction to the experience. I think the whole story is told in 41 through 4. And then he just reviews, as he often does, right, the redemptive history. So it's not just this isolated incident of deliverance that causes him to praise. He could look back and he would say, this has happened time and time again. There are many people that are going to see it, and there are many things that God has done in the past. I can't even, and you, could you even remember all of the ways that God has been faithful to you? All of the ways God was faithful to Israel? All of the stories left untold throughout all of Israelite history, or even the Gospels, as they say in the end of the Gospels, you know, many other things happened, but this is all that we wrote down, you know, because this was the scope of our book. And there's just so many things, and in our life, so many ways that we could look back and see time after time after time, God faithfully bringing us out of the miry pit, faithfully setting our feet on the rock. Can you recount them all? Can you recount all of God's faithful thoughts to you? Can you put them in order? Can you remember when they all happened? If you would declare and speak of them, they are more than can be numbered. Again, looking back a couple weeks in 2 Peter, if God knows how to faithfully deliver Noah, if God knows how to faithfully deliver Lot, then doesn't he know how to faithfully deliver you? Absolutely, he does. Then there's this really interesting section, 6-8. Let's just read through that one more time. Sacrifice and offering, here's parallel lines, you did not desire. Parentheses, my ears you have opened. Burnt offering and sin offering, you did not require. Then I said, behold, I come. In the scroll of the book, it is written of me, I delight to do your will, O my God, and your law is within my heart. This is quoted in Hebrews 10 in the author's line of argument about the ineffective nature of the law its power is unable to perfect sinners. But then he moves to God's effective grace to perfect sinners in chapter 10, 1 through 10, I think. And this exact section is quoted. It says that in the incarnation of Christ, the incarnation said, or Christ said, sacrifice and offering you didn't desire, my ears you have opened. Burnt offering and sin offering you did not require. Then I said, behold, I come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me, I delight to do your will. Oh my God, and your law is within my heart. So we do have David historically, and then we have the move to Jesus ultimately. And the point that he's getting at the end of the day is that in the incarnation, we have this timeless truth proclaimed that sacrifice and offering, all of these animal sacrifices and offerings, are not ultimately what please God, but that he desires perfect obedience. He desires people to come and delight to do his will, right? Delight to obey and have that be the nature of their heart, that the Torah is there. Like, that's where it lives and it flows from there. Kind of like the person in Psalm 1 who's deeply rooted in the Torah and is just like this flourishing tree. That's what he desires. And the law exposed that we don't do that well. Doesn't change the desire, God's desire. And so he gave Christ in order to be this one who came to delight to do the will of God, to do what we could not do. So this picture of David, it's not that God didn't want them to have sacrifice and offering or burnt offering and sin offering. I mean, these are God's ideas. But it's that for them to remember that the point of them was not in them. The point of them was to point them to something else. It's sort of like if a father was trying to teach his son a good work ethic. And so he, you know, says, okay, we're going to move this pile of rocks over here and it's going to be difficult and we're going to do it, but it's going to, you know, there's a time to move stones. And so we're going to do that. And they do that. And the son just thinks like, this is all about moving rocks. They're like, I'm going to be really good at moving rocks. And they get to the end of the day and maybe the son's still just like this person who's like, well, I got the idea, Dad. It's good to move rocks from A to B. And you're like, that's not really the point. The point is to teach you work hard, or like the work ethic or something like that. And if you just sacrifice as the end in and of itself, then we've missed the point. The point was to draw us to point out our sin or to be this evidence of thanksgiving or something like that. There were various, you know, reasons for the offering. So he's saying ultimately that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for people who delight to do the will of God, people who love to obey, people who have the law written in their hearts. And that ultimately is fulfilled in Christ. In 9 and 10, we have, I think, the further description of the song that he sings, praise to our God and many seeing it. It's that description, 9 and 10. And here, just observe the, I don't know, just the lists, essentially. So I have proclaimed what? The good news of righteousness in the great assembly. Indeed, I do not restrain my lips. O Lord, you yourself know. I have not hidden your righteousness within my heart. I have declared your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your loving kindness and your truth from the great assembly. So he's just listing, right? There's a couple positive statements. I have proclaimed. I have declared. And then there's a couple negative statements. I don't restrain my lips. I have not hidden righteousness. I have not concealed your loving kindness and your truth. So in his activity, there's some poetry, positive and negative, what he is and isn't doing. And then in the description of what he's praising in God, there's his righteousness, meaning his righteous deeds, his deliverance of him. He hasn't hidden that righteousness, his faithfulness and his salvation or his faithful saving. And then he hasn't concealed the loving kindness, you know, the loyal love of God and his truth, or his, again, sort of faithful deeds is kind of the idea there. From the great assembly, so from, you know, all of Israel, they haven't hidden those things. So he's just saying, he's evidencing, like, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do when you deliver me. I'm singing. I'm rejoicing. I'm showing people your faithfulness. And there is, again, much to be thankful for. So all of these things are kind of pointing back to all of these many wonderful works of the Lord. He does list them out a bit, you know, righteousness, faithfulness, salvation, loving kindness, truth. And then there's just this prayer, this cry. Here, I believe it is intended to be, it could grammatically be either. But when he says, do not withhold, that can also be, you will not withhold, or you will not restrain. And I think he is, in this case, trying to make a statement of faith. It's like, you will not, or you will withhold, sorry, you will not withhold, I can't even see that, your tender mercies from me, O Lord. Let your, or your loving kindness and your truth will continually preserve me. And so the last pair that he looked at in verse 10 is the pair he refers to in verse 11. The loving kindness and the truth of God will preserve his people. He promises deliverance by his character. If God is a loyal God, then you will be preserved. If God is a truthful God, then you will be preserved. Then he gets to the lament, right? The description of what is going on. And here's where there's two things. You know, he says, innumerable evils have surrounded me. And then he describes his sin, right? My iniquities have overtaken me so that I'm not able to look up. They, either the evils or the iniquities, are more than the hairs of my head. Therefore, my heart fails me. Now, what follows is all describing people, right? Them who do this, them who do this, them who do this. So he seems to be talking about people, but perhaps this is people doing things as a response to his sin. Maybe he's just very aware of both. You know, maybe his responses in the situation are just overwhelmingly wrong. He's discouraged and angry and upset or whatever it might be. Maybe he's lashed out. Maybe he's prompted the situation. But both are in front of him. The innumerable evils of others and his own innumerable evils. Isn't that oftentimes difficult to parse in our trials? Why is it happening? Did I do something wrong? Well, I'm not responding very well. Okay, maybe this, I'm doing better now, and then I'm angry about it again. And that, you know, even in, I was texting Ellen the other day and was just like thanking her for their example of faith through this situation with just uncertainty and questions. And, you know, she responds with like, well, don't think that I haven't had my moments, you know. I was like, well, that's, of course, like we all have. We have iniquities overtaking us constantly. Even in our righteousness, we have iniquities. So much so that we can't even see. So much so that it just feels like you can't even lift up your head. Is the pit the oppressive situation or is it you? Good question. Yes. More than the hairs of my head are these enemies and my sins. And our heart is just overwhelmed, struggling, failing, weak. And so his prayer, he starts and ends with himself. He starts with me and then, you know, those who seek you. And in between, he prays against those who are opposing him. So let's look at that. Be pleased in verse 13, O Lord, to deliver me. I think it's a neat connection. If you say, Lord, would you be pleased to deliver me as I am pleased to do what you have asked me to do, as I delight to obey, would you please be delighted to keep your word, right, to deliver me? And please do so quickly. It would be better if it was sooner than later. I'm in this pit. I'm surrounded. I'm overwhelmed. Help. And then he just speaks against, in this poetry, three parallel lines, 1, 2, 3, let them be ashamed and brought to confusion who are trying to destroy me. Let them be driven backward and brought to dishonor who wish me evil. Let them be confounded because of their shame, those who say to me, aha, aha. Which is, you know, that condescending, triumphant cry of the victor, you know, the oppressor. I can do with you what I want. You're my prey. And they're just after his life, wishing him evil. So, you know, it's all parallel. I don't know that details are more helpful in painting the picture. You know, they have shame, confusion. They'd be on the retreat. They'd be brought to dishonor. They'd even be, like, surprised and, like, amazed at how much shame they were brought because of the way that they've chosen to live, because of their wickedness. And then he ends again with his prayer for himself. But, and it is parallel, so they didn't do a very good job in this translation, I don't think, doing the parallelism, but so those who, oh, let's see. Let all those who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. Okay, there, okay, sorry. So he does two requests for these people. Those who seek God, instead of destroying the lives of others with evil, may they rejoice and be glad. And let such as love your salvation, those people say, the Lord be magnified. Now, when would they say the Lord be magnified? Upon deliverance. Right, the Lord is great. Look at what he's done. And until then, I think we have in verse 17, the description of verse 1, his waiting. Until then, until I can say the Lord is magnified, I will wait in my need, in my lack. I have nothing. I have no riches. I have no sustenance. My heart is, you know, has failed me. I am poor and needy, and yet I'm resting in the fact that the Lord thinks upon me, that the Lord has not forgotten me, that the Lord will hear my prayer, that he will, even as I wait in the seeming silence, you know, the silence of God. One of my favorite artists has a song called The Silence of God, Andrew Peterson. It just says it can drive a man crazy, like the seeming silence of God. But he's resting in the fact that the silence will be broken. And that this, much like, you know, a Psalm 46, you are my help, you are my deliverer. And once again, please come quickly. Don't delay. Do so quickly, oh my God. So it's a psalm, again, it sort of spins around in various patterns and is not the normal pattern of a song, but it's the song of someone post-trial, post-song, right, who's already rejoiced in front of the assembly, and now he recounts this. And in so doing, I think he's just setting up the circuit, like he's setting up how this goes constantly in our lives. It goes miry pit. I have my sin. I'm seeing oppression. My heart has failed. I want to be someone who comes to delight in the will of God. I want to be someone whom God would be pleased to deliver because of his loving kindness that's been set upon me. And so I will wait patiently. So I will continue crying. I will wait in the mud until the one who has the ability to set my feet on the rock arrives and the light shines above this dark hole and he reaches his arm out down and delivers me. And when he does so, I will proclaim the good news of righteousness in the great assembly. I'm going to respond because he's put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to God, the song that says, "The Lord be magnified." And then we have this example in 6 through 8 of the person and the work of Jesus ultimately fulfilled. Right? That he, and there's some really interesting, we don't really have the time for it, but there's some really interesting things going on between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint that's quoted in Hebrews 10. But the point, foundational point being that the incarnate Christ proclaims that truth, right? That he was given this body equipped for obedience, and then he lived it. As it was written of him, he delighted to do the will of God, and God's law was in his heart. And we have inside of him hope. Hope that we will be delivered, that he was the ultimate sacrifice, which is the point Hebrews is trying to make. You know, that the effective grace of God is available for sinners. It perfects sinners. So it's just a psalm of encouragement, a psalm of encouragement in the middle of trial. So I hope that is a blessing to you, something that you can meditate on throughout this week, throughout the individual things going on in our lives, and even that we can encourage other people with. It's encouraging when you're in the pit to hear of someone who's gotten out of it. So I hope that it's nourishing to your